Welcome to Attachment Theory in Action, a weekly podcast presented by the Knowledge Center at Chaddock. Join host Karen Doyle Buckwalter for an insightful, informative, and inspiring conversation with leading researchers, authors, and clinicians discussing issues in attachment theory. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and share with your professional network. For additional resources, training opportunities, and blogs, please visit tkcchaddock.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Attachment Theory in Action podcast. I'm your host, Karen Doyle Buckwalter, joining you for another episode. I'm going to be interviewing two people today. I typically only have interviews with one person, but these women wrote this book together and requested that we do the interview together. So let me tell you a little bit about the book and then about the authors. The book that we are going to be talking about in the podcast is called Reclaim Compassion: The Adoptive Parent's Guide to Overcoming Blocked Care with Neuroscience and Faith. And this book is by Lisa Qualls and Melissa Corkum. Some of my listeners out there may be familiar with them and the work that they have done in the adoption community. But let me give you a little bit of background. First, Lisa Qualls is the author of The Connected Parent that was written along with Dr. Karen Purvis. She is a TBRI practitioner and a Christian spiritual director. As a birth mom and an adoptive mom, she writes and speaks with wisdom about the challenges and beauty of adoption. She lives with her husband in Idaho. So that is Lisa. And then Melissa is an adoptee and an adoptive mom. Melissa Corkum provides insight and resources to adoptees and their parents through her writing, her coaching, and her speaking. She is also a Safe and Sound Protocol practitioner and a certified Enneagram coach. Melissa lives in Maryland, and I'm really looking forward to what they are going to be sharing with us in the podcast today. Some of you may be familiar with the concept of blocked care. I first learned about it through the writing of John Balin and Dan Hughes. So stay tuned. This is an important concept for people to understand and know how to deal with. And my guests will be coming right up.
Supporting children and families who have experienced great loss and endured extreme trauma is a daunting task. At Chaddock, we have the experience and longevity to understand the type of support needed to keep the best and brightest engaged with this work. In July, the Knowledge Center at Chaddock will launch the next session of the Developmental Trauma and Attachment Institute for helpers who seek to be rejuvenated and revitalized in their work with children and families. This type of renewal and confidence is a natural byproduct of gaining specialized knowledge, advanced skills, consultation, guidance, mentorship, and most importantly, being in a community providing the experience of being seen and understood. We have designed an experience and a soft place to land where all of these needs will be met in one central place. For more information on the Developmental Trauma and Attachment Institute, to join the waitlist for more information, or to sign up, visit tkcchaddock.org.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Attachment Theory in Action podcast. I'm here to continue my discussion with Lisa Qualls and Melissa Corkum about their recently released book, Reclaim Compassion. And it is a book about overcoming blocked care. And last week, we talked quite a bit about the neuroscience and how brain chemistry is impacted by this, how it evolves from the child's blocked trust and the parent's blocked care, and we don't get this reinforcing feedback loop going. We want to also talk more today about practical strategies that you guys are suggesting in the book. And you really made an effort to make this practical, I could tell.
Yeah, it's every chapter ends with five simple practices. And kind of the way we designed it, and we realized that because of time and parents' busy schedules, it might not all go this way, but it could be a chapter a week. It's 10 chapters. And then you kind of, you know, read on the first end of the week, and then there's five simple practices, kind of one for every day, like, you know, Monday through Friday or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that starts, even though the part three is solely focused on how to overcome block care, there are practices throughout the entire book. And so far, the folks that have read it have said to us that that has felt, we tried really hard to make it not feel like homework, like not be like extra, like if you're reading this book, like, and here's some extra work. But what we're really thrilled that parents have said to us is that it's really nice because it gives them a pause and some processing time between each chapter to intentionally kind of process and move through, rather than kind of drinking through the fire hose the entire time.
Yes. So before we leap into those practical strategies, I did think it would be good if we could review the signs of blocked care. Like, as you're listening, you know, maybe a therapist listened to part one of this and like, oh yeah, that sounds maybe like some people that I, some folks that I work with or a parent, but let's, if they sort of wanted to screen themselves for this, I think these 10 strategies that, that you guys talk about in the book, and maybe just list, I mean, we could do a whole podcast just on those, of course, but I think just kind of listing them as sort of an assessment of oneself. Would you, I could read them. You guys could talk about it. What? So the first one is, I'm too caught up in coping in my child's behavior to be curious about the meaning behind it. Well, that would be a problem, wouldn't it? Because we're talking a lot about needing to be curious and needing to be non-judgmental and needing to parent at the child's developmental age and not their chronological age. What do you guys want to, is there an additional sentence you would throw in about that one?
Well, I do think that as parents often, I think that's one place where maybe parents sometimes feel a little judged by therapists. And even by people who are teaching about connected parenting, like us, because we're always told, what's the meaning behind your child's behavior? Be curious. And the parents are often like, you know what? I don't care. I just want it to stop. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Because their nervous system has, they've developed this block care, and being curious is kind of gone at that point.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to read through the rest of them. I feel defensive and guard myself from rejection. I feel burned out, chronically overwhelmed and fatigued. I feel resentment towards one or more of my children or my situation as a whole. I may even regret adopting or fostering. I feel irritable with other family members. I isolate myself. I'm cynical about helpful ideas, and you did mention that in part one of our podcast. I do have to throw in there, sometimes I don't blame parents because some of the ideas haven't been helpful, but
true.
So I've lost.
You can always tell when an idea comes from someone who actually hasn't lived it, like when it's a theoretical idea.
I've lost compassion, which has led to shame. We also really talked, you know, hit in on that in our first part of the interview. I've experienced a crisis of faith or a challenge of a personal belief system, and I don't feel real pleasure in parenting. And I do think about half of those we kind of hit as we were talking last time. One that jumps out at me is the crisis of faith. And I have always felt that when people decided to foster and adopt for at least partially faith-based reasons, it seems to be another layer of shame. Because now I'm not just disappointing myself and not being who I wish I could be for this child, but now I'm disappointing God. So that does add to the complexity, I think, of the shame. Would you guys agree?
I think it does. And I think for a lot of parents who felt like they were following God's calling or a leading from God, and then to feel like somehow it's all gone so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like their family, maybe they have other children who are really suffering. Maybe their marriage is under great strain. Maybe they themselves are just struggling so much. And mm-hmm. So then I think this this feeling of confusion and sadness and anger. Like, where does the anger go? Does it go toward your spouse, who maybe it was all their big idea? Does it go toward the children who have far more needs than you ever imagined? Does it go to the therapist who has great ideas that don't work, or to the agency that let this happen in the first place? Like, shouldn't they have known we shouldn't have done this? Because it's really, really hard to just direct the anger at, and just say, God, I'm really mad about this. Mm-hmm. I was doing my very best. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm being punished somehow. I've done something. Yeah. And so, you know, I know that God can handle our anger, and I think we should go ahead and let him have it because he can handle it.
Yes.
But I do think it's confusing for a lot of parents who are believers, you know, yes. in God.
Yes. Yes. So, getting to this piece about what to do, I do want to mention, in addition to all your ideas and strategies, there is a journal type aspect to some of the chapters where parents are asked to write about certain things. So there is a little bit of, it's not a workbook. It's not so much that it's like every page like that, but so you are suggesting, you know, writing about, you know, what your expectations were, you know, why you decided to adopt. It is shocking to me how infrequently that is asked. Like, why did you decide to do this? I see that a lot in clinical work where no one asks that. I'm like, you know, that's really important to ask, you know? But so you guys bring that up. And so how have your idea to put exercises where people will write, tell listeners, you know, why that was important to you guys and why you think that's helpful in helping overcome blocked care?
I think in the spirit of just us being stuck, you know, blocked care feels like a very stuck place. It feels very isolating. But there's a lot, we write a little bit about disenfranchised grief and ambiguous yes. loss, right? Yes. These idea where I do hear it talked about more now, but I think for so long, grief was what we were allowed to feel when your mother died or you lost a child or maybe a pet, right? But we've identified these kind of intangible losses around our family identity, our identity as parents, our the loss of expectations. You know, if we thought we were going to adopt, like in our story, we adopted older children who at the beginning told us they were so excited to come into our family and all they wanted was a mom and a dad, but their expectations of what a mom and a dad were and what they did. Like one of our daughters at one point said, well, you're a mom. Isn't your job just to say yes to us? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, like that's what she was saying yes to when we adopted her at 13. She was saying, yes, I would love to come live in a house in America where someone could say yes to me all the time. Right. And we were saying yes to, yes, we would love to have you be a part of our family. And we would love to provide the structure and the guidance, you know, for you to become what we hope is the best version of yourself. And sometimes that will include us saying, no, you can't do that. We don't think that's a good idea, or it's not inside our budget or inside our limitation, you know, within our limitations. And so you take all of that, and sometimes parents are stuck in that grief. And so even if we talk about ways to get out of blocked care, until you can kind of work your way through the grief and kind of get to the point where you have some of that acceptance, radical acceptance in where you are, then it's almost a moot point to talk about the blocked care if we're still stuck in the grief of we thought we were going to get into adopting kids for this reason and almost none of those things turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm.
I think another source of grief for parents is just that, you know, we all have a family culture and the way we live and move through the world as a family. And I know that I thought, okay, we have this beautiful, loving family. We want to bring children in who don't have this and give them all this love and security and everything. And, you know, my husband described it like we were like a train on a track, and we thought we were going to sort of scoop the children up and bring them into our train and continue down the track. And that was completely false. Our train derailed completely. And then we had to get on a different track because our life changed so much. We weren't the family we were before. We weren't just going to incorporate these children into what we already were. We had to become something new. And it was a painful letting go, you know, like giving up being a homeschool family, which we'd been for 16 years. You know, it just didn't fit anymore. There were things that just no longer worked for us anymore. Like, let's all hop in the car and take a long road trip. That did not work with our new children. So it took me a while to realize, oh, I'm actually deeply, deeply sad, and I need to grieve this. So we encourage parents to really, really be honest about what were those expectations, and then how do they process the gap between their expectations and the reality that they're living right now?
All right. And that brings to mind a father that I worked with that said, well, you know, when we adopted our son, you know, we're like, oh, what college will he go to? You know, what is he going to like? You know, all of these hopes and dreams that people have for their children. And then it was like, oh, you know, maybe he's not going to go to college. You know, we're seeing whatever it was in the child's life, whether it was learning disabilities, whatever thing. So, okay, so, or maybe he just doesn't want to do that. So like, oh gosh, there's going to be some kind of trade or something he's going to enjoy to do in his life. And okay. And then it was like, gradually it was like, are we going to get him through high school? Like, what's going to happen when he's discharged from the psychiatric unit at the local hospital? And then each of those was like another grieving process. And it stuck with me that it's not, if someone, although, you know, I love Pauline Boss, you mentioned, but the myth of closure, like, really, is there even closure, or is this an ongoing thing that we do when we grieve? But when someone dies, there's like this concrete thing that happens, and that's what happened. And you begin to learn to live without them. And I remember thinking when that father was speaking, just like this key, like, okay, there's that. And okay, now there's this, and now there's this, and that process being very different. Yeah. Yeah. So I think you're bringing out this point about working on grief and loss as part of this blocked care process. You know, I think sometimes we like overemphasize, this is a big pet peeve of mine, overemphasizing psychoeducation. I'll just explain blocked care and like, then this will all get better. And like, it doesn't attend to the emotional experience of grief, of loss, of pain, of hurt, you know? So I was so happy to see that you guys were bringing all of that into the book. All right. So another favorite was my joy list, the joy list. So why don't you share that practical strategy and how you guys incorporated that in your lives?
Well, we learned about that from Deborah Gray, who is an incredible therapist and author. And, you know, my family had the extreme gift of her being our therapist. And so she taught me about it initially, and I read about it in Attaching and Adoption. She originally called it something different, but we found that it was a really great entry point for a lot of parents, because what she taught us was that when parents are under this kind of stress, they basically delete joy from their lives. They just, their heads are down. They're just going from one thing to the next, to the next. And I think I remember myself feeling like, if I change my course, if I deviate even a tiny bit, everything is going to fall apart, because, you know, when everything's out of control, we try to control things more. And so the thought of joy was just the farthest thing from my mind. And she told me, okay, I want you to brainstorm a list of 50 things, 50, not 15, but 50 that give you joy. And they can be tiny. Like my list is, has everything from like really great things, like going out for a meal with my husband or something, to every time I peel a tangerine, I literally pause and inhale the fragrance, you know, or I light a candle on my desk, or I step out on the back porch and take 3 deep breaths. Yes. And so what we found was, when we encourage parents to do this, we encourage them to make this big list, and it may take them a while. And then we ask them to do 7 of these things every day. They can do the same thing multiple times. It doesn't matter. But what we're trying to do is have them, during the course of a week, do 50 things. We call it 50 points of joy, that 50 things that give them just a little spark of joy. And what we know is that it begins to change parents' brain chemistry.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I thought that that was really great. And you also talk about, you know, getting back to Deanne Hughes and dyadic developmental psychotherapy and John Baylin. You talk about PACE, which many listeners might know. It's playful, accepting, curious, and empathic. And you really brought out a lot about playfulness. And I also think that under stress, you lose your playfulness.
My personality is to grasp for control. And I think probably a lot of parents, right, when we get into these really stressful situations, one of the things, we're our heads down trying to control all the things, right? And we don't think we can let go of anything to make room for either joy or playfulness. My play style is not the get on the floor and play pretend type things. I think also it was important for us to point out that there are different ways to play and kind of add fun back in. But I'm one of those people that, while I understand psychoeducation isn't everything, I'm also super motivated by some really good psychoeducation to convince me to do something playful. Like if you were just like, Melissa, you just need to lighten, like, you know, if I were in a therapist's office and someone was like, you just need to lighten up and be a little bit more playful, you know, I would probably feel really resistant and cynical to that. But as I read things from Deanne Hughes and Bruce Perry and saw the brain science behind, like I think it was Bruce Perry that said, maturity is the accumulation of positive social emotional interactions, right, in a person's life. And I think back to the ways I try to control the development of maturity in my kids with extra lectures or more structure, more rules, more boundaries, more lessons, books, you know, whatever the thing is. None of those feel really fun to me or the kids. And then to just have this glaring definition of maturity from someone I really respect saying, nope, it's not found in any of those things. It's found in the positive social emotional interactions, and thinking, well, those things are the things that are playful and fun and joking and lighter. And so that like kind of backdoor into maturity really struck a chord with me. And so again, it's like that psychoeducation piece was like, okay, well, now that I see the brain science behind why fun is important, maybe now I can, you know, make it a goal to be more playful, introduce more fun into the situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have always felt that if I can get a family laughing, they're gonna make it. You know, really having laughter and fun together. I see that as a therapist, one of my main jobs is to get some of the, you know, that's one of the reasons I love TheraPlay so much. But one of my main jobs is to help orchestrate that, you know, if they are in a stuck place, to be able to orchestrate ways of connecting that are bringing laughter again. And I do think it sometimes takes an outside person to kind of come in and help with that when you're so stuck and so depleted. So playfulness. And
can I add one thing to that, Karen?
Yes, please do.
I think sometimes too, as parents, we feel like if we do something playful, we're rewarding a child. Yeah. Like if yeah. their behavior
we're losing a battle yeah, or something.
That could be it. Losing a battle, or like if a child's behavior has consumed the family all afternoon, and then we do something special and fun, we feel like somehow we're going to be rewarding it or not providing the appropriate consequences or something. And I think what Melissa points out that's so important is that actually fun is good for all of our nervous systems. It's not just a reward. So we talk about the foundation of fun. And I mentioned my friend Andrea, who every Friday after school, they have bottles of root beer and cookies. And it doesn't matter how bad the week has been. It doesn't matter how bad the day has been. And it's not, and no child is excluded. No matter what, they know that this one special fun thing is going to happen every Friday. So Melissa is actually really, she says she's not that great at fun. She's actually super good at fun compared to me. But foundation of fun is something she talks about a lot with our families.
Yes. Yes. Melissa, you look like maybe you wanted to add something.
Well, I think the thing that struck me, and I think this comes from a Dan Hughes concept too, is the key is to foundation of fun is that it's routine. So it happens no matter what, and it's rhythmic enough that it's like every day at roughly the same, like every day after school or every Friday for dinner or something like that. And so I think it can feel a lot more, you know, quote unquote, dangerous to have an end of a really bad day and be like, oh, today was a bad day, let's do something fun, versus this is something that's already built into our rhythm and routine. And it's there when we have good days, and it's still there when we have bad days. But we kind of have to establish it as a routine for it to not feel like it's just a reward. And in some ways, if we establish small foundation of fun moments, I mean, we have families that, like, you know, just watch a silly YouTube video together or Alexa tell them a funny joke. And you can do that, you know, every day, and it's free and it doesn't take that long, that those things not only don't reward big behaviors, negative behaviors, but they often can pattern interrupt a cycle of dysregulation, because then it's also not being used as, hey, if you stop, we'll do something fun. It's, hey, it's after, this is our after school thing. You know, I'm inviting you to come join me for this thing that we do every day after school, even if I see that you're having a hard time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's helpful too, because they're, one of the things I've often tried to work on with parents is the children don't earn the right to nurture and fun. Like, it's got to be found. And I know it feels like you want them to, but the reality is, based on how this is going, they're not that's going to mean they're not going to get it, because they're not going to earn it. And we know they need to have that. And it has to be seen as a right of a child to have that. I think that those were all such wonderful ideas. And I know we're winding down here, but I have to point out one more other section I really loved was when you were talking about the sensory needs of the parent. And because, you know, we hear this all the time, you know, sensory processing issues, sensory this, sensory. And now we do. I mean, 20 years ago, I don't think anyone even, I remember my first training where an OT talked about it. And I was like, what? But I don't hear people talking about it enough with parents. And you guys have that as part of the care of the parent's nervous system. And I think what I felt was the bottom line with this book was, the parents are going to have to take care of their nervous system to be in a place to meet the needs of their children and not fall into blocked care. So I really liked how you pointed out the sensory needs of parents too. So I thought that was really great.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many data points that our nervous systems, like our kid, we, you know, like you said, Karen, we focus a lot on our kids. And I tell parents all the time, our return on investment, because we don't actually have control over our kids, you know, we can provide safe spaces for them and we can influence them, but we ultimately don't control them. And so I think I spent a lot of time running in and out of different therapy offices, different modalities, you know, and willing my kids to take advantage of the tools that we were adding to their toolbox. And sometimes it was great, and sometimes it felt that, you know, there was a lot of resistance from our kids. And so when I realized how the return on investment, if I cared for my own nervous system and just even in the midst of chaos with my kids could be this kind of anchored co-regulatory force in my house. Like, you know, we tell parents a lot, like, don't underestimate how much power your nervous system has in a household. And we hope that that doesn't sound like we're blaming parents or putting like an undue burden of stress on their shoulders, but more that sometimes in these situations where families are in crisis, it feels like we're powerless. And so we hope that helping parents understand what they can do for their nervous system gives them some of their power back, because they've been trying to do these things for their kids and they feel powerless. But then when they can turn it to themselves, they realize, oh, like I can affect change by focusing somewhere else that feels more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you two, you dynamic duo, you. Again, the title is Reclaim Compassion, the Adoptive Parent's Guide to Overcoming Blocked Care with Neuroscience and Faith. Any other resources, closing comments, websites, anything you want to share with listeners about the wonderful work you're doing out there in the world, please take time to do that now.
Well, one thing we want to mention is that you read through the 10 signs of blocked care.
Yes.
We have this assessment available for your listeners.
Okay.
On our website. They just go to theadoptionconnection.com/attachment.
Yes.
And they can take this really simple. It takes like a couple minutes assessment. And then they will get information on resources that we have, you know, the book. We have a community of really incredible adoptive parents all working through blocked care together. Actually, they're not all just adoptive parents. We also right. have parents who are not adoptive or foster parents who are working through overcoming blocked care together. Melissa, what else would you add in terms of resources?
I think that's about it. But I think the assessment's a really good place to start to just have. I'm a really data-driven person. So to just know where you're starting and to kind of have a picture of, and sometimes it can be really sobering, but I think, you know, knowledge is power. And like G.I. Joe said, you know, knowing's half the battle. Like, so you know where we are, and then you know where you are, and then you know where the resources are and which resources are the best ones. I think the other part is, even if you're a pre-adoptive parent or you're listening thinking, I'm not quite into blocked care yet. Like I don't
not quite that bad.
Yeah. It's not quite that bad. But I think the book is helpful because I think back to before I was in blocked care and I wish I had known these signs.
Yes.
So that I could have figured it out. Because what we will tell you is that small amounts of blocked care are easier to overcome.
Yes.
Than when you give the maximum, like when you answer always to all 10 of the signs. It's a yes. much deeper hole to climb out of. And so I wish I would have known earlier that
yes.
this was a slope that I was sliding down. So I think mm-hmm. it's a great resource to just have in your back pocket, even if you don't read it cover to cover or do all the exercises, to just kind of read parts 1 and 2, maybe skip the exercises for now and just know what could happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And I think for the therapist listening, you have the ability to influence these parents probably more than you know. Gosh, it chokes me up. Sorry. As a mom. But you have the ability to bring empathy and compassion to the parents. Mm-hmm. And that is the first step toward helping their nervous system open and yeah. for them beginning to have any kind of hope. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more you understand blocked care so that you can help parents understand it, it just, it makes a huge difference
Yes.
And I believe you have the ability to help parents come a long way in their healing, to then help them be the parents that they both long to be and the parents that their kids need them to be.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you so much for giving your time to the podcast today. I know it's going to be a source of encouragement, information, hope to everyone listening. And I encourage listeners to get the book. It's very, very good book, both for professionals and parents. So thank you again for being here.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Yeah, thanks again for having us.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Attachment Theory in Action. Please follow our site, tkcchaddock.org, or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts for future episodes. If you enjoy our podcast, please leave a review and share with your professional network. For additional resources, training opportunities, and blogs, please visit tkcchaddock.org. We hope you'll join us again as we continue to explore the world of adoption, trauma, and attachment theory.